In the early morning hours of February 25th, 1991, an Iraqi scout element surprised a forward outpost occupied by the 1st Marine Division near the Bergen oil fields of southeastern Kuwait. With surprise and violence of action on their side, the Iraqis had the advantage over the Americans in their light armored vehicles. Or so they thought. Inside one of seven LAVs under attack was Captain Eddie Ray, a former University of Washington college football player turned battlefield tactician, who spent the past several months training his troops to learn his football-inspired battlefield playbook. With every play, Eddie signaled over the radio, his Marines knew exactly what tactical maneuver to follow. In swift, calculated actions, Eddie's Marines eliminated the scout element, only to discover the small Iraqi force was part of a much larger mechanized brigade. Eddie called the next play. This time, they'd be on the offensive. Seven LAVs, like an offensive line formation, and two Cobra gunships, like a tight end on each shoulder, versus 50-plus Iraqi vehicles. I'm Matt Freitas, the host of the Late Night History Podcast, and for 3 hours, broken up into two parts for episode 36, Eddie shares his life story. Tonight, you'll hear Eddie recount his Navy Cross action in his words. Later in the show, Eddie recalls serving as a battalion commander under General Mattis in the 03 Iraq invasion, reflections about his legacy, and his thoughts about the future of armor in warfare, with the prevalence of drones and other evolutionary capabilities. Here is part two with a Marine's Marine, Eddie Ray.
The whole idea was if the Iraqis move south into Saudi Arabia, we were there as an early warning. And, we were they'd call it the speed bump, because they're going to be much more than what we had. And so that's pretty much our mission. And so I just, so that being said, we started training. And so, we made up maneuvers. I sat down with my lieutenants and the, platoon sergeants and my first sergeant, we just made up maneuvers, basically. Just if we're getting attacked from the right, this is how we're going to do it. This is how we're going to do it. This is how we're going to move. This is how we're going to move in formation. This is how we're going to shift from a traveling formation to an attack formation. We just kind of made stuff up.
And was it based off of any like historical battles or historical things, or was it just kind of you guys are winging it?
We were winging it, because part of it had, it had to do a lot with, I knew and we knew as being infantry, how to maneuver if you're just walking. Except we weren't, and we had a big. We had a big flat area that we were operating in, so we didn't have anything to really work with. Kind of made it up. But also another piece of it was how to do it and how to get to that level of efficiency that came from football. It just kind of how to keep not just learn a play, but how to execute the play, working on the timing, the sequence, getting that sort of thing. That came from football, and we had nothing but time on our hands. So we did it, worked day and night, and we tried so many things and a lot of scenarios and maneuvers. We realized wasn't going to work because of maybe in nighttime, we didn't have needed visibility for it to work. other things. Realized that vehicles didn't respond the way we wanted them to. So we kind of we practiced so many things, and what I learned coaching was something that I needed to practice. For me, I needed to practice giving commands, like in coaching, I learned that you only have about 30 seconds between each play. And so I had to be able to work in this sequence where I had to decide what play was going to be and then articulate that play to somebody with enough time for them to articulate it to the team and then for them to execute it. And I had to get it all done when back then I think we had like 45 seconds. And so what I knew I needed to kind of work on my personal rhythm in this sequence. And so I started doing that while we trained. That's what I would do. I'd call formation changes, address in a brevity. I use brevity codes, if you will, so that if I said something, said one word, everybody knew what that word was, what the play was. And so I worked on that. And we rehearsed it for months. And another thing that I learned in playing calling plays, I used to call plays on the offense, was that I only looked at the defense when I called plays. Never paid any attention to the offense because I knew what the offense was going to do from practice. And that's what, when I watched the defense, that's how the next offensive play came to my mind, is I saw something that the defense did. Never looked at the offense. I carried that to the battlefield. We rehearsed all our maneuvers. We did everything to the point where I knew what, if I told somebody, told them what to do, I knew what they were going to do. So I didn't have to look at them. I only looked at the enemy. I paid attention to what the threat was doing. That's all I did. And I'd give commands. Never looked to my right or left. I just knew they were there, or they had to be there. And so that's, but no, that's how it worked. That's where a General Maya once said something like, he gave me one of the great compliments. Says, I've never seen fire and support maneuver happen so sequentially and so organized, in a battlefield like that. And we had rehearsed it to the point where we weren't making it up as we went along. It was just, this is what we did. And so it wasn't like when I was watching when we were in this firefight with the Rockies, we're going against basically an armored brigade. I could see them. I could tell by their pauses that whoever was in charge was giving them orders. He was literally telling them sequentially what to do. And these pauses were apparent to me because this was where we were when we first started our training. We're well past that now. But in watching, I saw the pause and I knew exactly what he was doing. He was literally telling him what to do. May have even been identifying and directing each vehicle individually. If because they weren't that organized. As soon as I noticed that, I knew it was time to attack. That's how we did it.
That's fascinating. But I also wanted to add is so light armored vehicles, the LAVs. So how big was the American side? How big was the Iraqi side? What type of weapon and weaponry did you have? And did like you have any air assets or anything? What did the Iraqis have? You kind of talk about that.
Well, in that encounter, it was about 50 of of them, a mix of armored and light armored vehicles they had, and it was seven of us, 25 millimeter, and we had called. It's interesting because when I saw them pausing like that, that was the time to call for air support. So we called for some helicopter support, Cobras and Cobra gunships. And so I knew that they were going to have another sequence, another pause. You could tell because of how they were working. And the Cobras showed up and they got there at about 10. Took no more than 10 minutes and they had arrived, and then we just put what we had rehearsed and my forward air controller, we had rehearsed what to do if we were had to attack, and that was to put Cobras on our shoulders. So we had two Cobras and we're basically in a line formation. Seven vehicles with two Cobras, and we just attacked. And whole idea was we were by attacking with the Cobras just over our heads, we were providing protection for the Cobras. Because the Cobras, they didn't get too high to where they were vulnerable to the surface to air missiles, that sort of thing. And we, with us shooting from the ground, nobody wanted to, who was crazy enough to stand up and jump out of their vehicle to shoot a SAM at a Cobra flying low. So it was a certain synergy that we rehearsed. Now, the thing is, we rehearsed it. We didn't know what Cobras were going to show up, but we knew what we rehearsed what. The fort, my fact was going to tell the pilots, and he did, and we moved out, and my to keep things simple for me, I called, our practice was that my vehicle was going to be the base vehicle, what I call the base vehicle, so everybody would orient themselves off my vehicle, so. So if I change direction of movement, then they'd have to adjust the formation to accommodate the direction of attack that I shifted to. That way, I didn't have to articulate much. It was anything I could do make things simple. And so that was my, that's why I just used myself as the base vehicle. Now people look at it and say, "Well, gee, well, man, that was, oh man, you were so brave doing that." I don't know. It's easy to feel brave when you got a whole bunch of guys that are, they're ready to fight right next to you. That's the first thing. Second thing is, I didn't have much choice. If I was on the right or the left wing or something like that, it wouldn't be as efficient. So I had to do it that way. It worked.
And what was the distance between the two forces?
Oh, gee, we ran right through them. Initially, when they came over the rise to where we could see them, they were, gee whiz, probably no more than a couple hundred yards, because they came from some low ground. Because I could see them, I could see the formation further away, but we didn't have that much visibility because the area was pretty smoked. We were, there was these oil fields were burning, and it was just smoke. The clouds blocked the sun, so it made it seem like night, even though it was daylight. The sun, it was just so many, these black clouds of smoke blocking the sun. So it was made it look like dark. And so it's no more than a couple of hundred yards.
And when the Iraqis first attacked, how long do you think that attack was?
It's funny, the attack went, there was a couple of them. The first attack, what got our attention was they had a scout element, four vehicles, four BMPs, as a matter of fact. And that was our first contact. And actually, it was somebody from the division headquarters was out roaming around looking for souvenirs or something. And they came screaming back in a Humvee, like, "Oh, they're out there, they're out there." Oh, And I looked behind them, and sure enough, maybe 50 yards, 50 to 100 yards, something like that, I could see this armored vehicle with tracks. And I'm looking at, I kind of look at it like, is this really happening? That's the first part. And the second thing is that this was a coalition. So you had all these other countries with basically Soviet type weapons with, and they were fighting with us. So that was another. So I'm looking at this vehicle, and I'm seeing this track, this, the US vehicles, all the US armored vehicles had what we call road wheel, these road wheels, and they had these road wheels that were that touch that the upper part of the track would rest on, and the Soviet vehicles didn't have those, so the track kind of dangles. So when you see it from the side, that was one of the things that I used to recognize the difference between US vehicles and Soviets, with that dangling track. And I looked, and it was like the dangling track. It's like, okay, this is definitely a Soviet vehicle. Now I got to make sure it's not a friendly one of the coalition vehicles. And so I'm still, we're getting reoriented, and I'm looking, and they take a shot at us. Okay. I can see that, I saw the flash. It's like, oh man, I guess this is not, this is not a friendly. So then my driver, I tell him, "Hey, just I think I said brake right, just brake right." That meant, floor it, go to the right about 45 degrees and floor it at the same, And he did, and I'm looking, literally this BMP is looking at, it's shooting at us, and there's a like a tree, like a palm tree that's maybe, I don't know, about a foot maybe in diameter. Said, "Aim for that tree." It's like, I don't know. For a moment, I'm thinking we could hide behind the tree. Well, and so we, but it did. He went for the tree, and then I swung the turret around, and I put the gunner on it. And we'd start, start shooting at it. And said, "Okay, because that's literally when I saw, because that the way it works is you got an override. There's two people in the turret, vehicle commander, which is my seat, and the gunner. and the gunner, and I have override. So when I grab this basically a joystick, I can slew the turret around and put him and aim. I'm literally standing outside the turret, basically, with, and I'm looking over the gun, and I'm aligning the gun by sight. I'm literally looking down the barrel, and and I'm aiming by looking down the barrel. So I'm it generally in the right, got him pointed in the right direction. Now he's looking through the gun sight. So I've got to get the barrel close enough to where when he looks through the gun sight, the target is in his field of view. And so literally when we aim for the tree, I slew the turret around, and I said, okay, you got a target 50 meters, like that. And he goes, got it. And he shoots three rounds, and I'm watching the like a red flash as they hit the armor. And then next thing you know, it's starting to smoke, and then another one shows up. Holy, this is like faster than I expected. Literally, because and so I said, okay, we got another one. And I told the driver, okay, now this time break left. So he turns, and we go. And the only reason why I wanted to move was because I didn't want to stay in one spot. And so we start moving, and I slew the turret around again. I said, okay, you got an enemy vehicle, 50 meters again. He goes, got it. And I watch, and he shoots three more bullets into the same one he just shot. And then it's like, oh my God, realization, he's been locked on the same one, and another one has already arrived. So I had to slew the turret around and get him on it. He said, okay, now, said, wrong vehicle, this is the vehicle, got it, okay. So he puts three more into that one. While he's putting three more into the second vehicle, the other vehicle that he hit blows up. Literally just boom. And this thing blows up, and I mean, I drop because I'm like, holy, But what it was that when he punctured the vehicles, I guess it had some internal fires, and so the ammunition inside the vehicle went up. And it was the weirdest thing was that when this thing starts, like I said, it starts smoking first. And I remember different colors of smoke, which was interesting because it's like first I saw like a yellow and a green, and maybe I'm thinking maybe it was some sort of signal, pyrotechnics in the vehicle or something. I don't know, but it started making different smoke colors, and along with the, like black, and then all of a sudden this goes boom, literally. That vehicle, the top flies off of it, and it's like it breaks apart. Literally, no more than, oh gee, it was about half the distance, maybe 25 meters away. Go, oh my goodness. So then, but what we had just taken on, and a couple of more vehicles, a couple of the other LAVs took out some more vehicles. About four or five of them. And later on, I realized that that was the scout element. In other words, they had vehicles ahead of their main body. And that's when that happened, we took those out, and I drove forward to like the edge, just to the edge of the rise, and I could see them. That's when I went, oh, here we go. So then I gave the order to get get some aircraft. And I briefed everybody that we're gonna go online and we're gonna when the opportunity comes, we're gonna attack. And I'm telling said this on the radio. My driver, he says, "Oh, okay, we're gonna die now." He said it in the intercom. It's Weaver. And I just said, "Shit, you just shut the fuck up." That was, I never had a doubt in him. He was just, it's sort of funny how the a sense of humor in this kind of in that kind of situation, that's the kind of stuff you say. It's like, it's like, hey, he wasn't about to run. And I knew he wasn't. And that was kind of his way of kind of,
Yeah, the crack at a joke.
And so I wasn't angry at him or anything. I just said, because that's the kind of response he needed to have. He expected anyway. That's when, the 10 minutes or so, and I'm watching, and I could see them. When we took out that scout element, I could see the front of his formation. He was trying to peel the front vehicles out so that they could establish an attack formation. But they were, it was almost like he was peeling them out individually. And I was worried. Yeah, I could see it. And my biggest worry was that the helicopters weren't going to get there in time, because I figured as long as they were in their movement formation or traveling formation, they'd be masked. They'd mask each other because they had one behind the other. But if they got into their assault formation, then of course they can bring all their guns to bear. And I was worried about that. But the only thing was that he was telling them, he was trying to get them into their assault formation almost individually. And I could see it. I could sense it. We had done that too many times. We've worked on it so much until I knew what he was trying to do. And the helicopters got there, and so I said, "Okay, we're moving up." Caught the first, no, I don't know, maybe five or six of them moving to the right and to the left when we attacked. And the rest of them were still in formation. We just ran right down the formation. And the thing was, it hitting them, it shooting them. We're so close to them until by the time we shot the vehicle, we had to kind of veer around the vehicle we just shot because it was about to explode. I could see the different color smoke coming out, and it's like, oh, so we kind of widen. And then come back, and you can see. So we went down this formation, ended up with about 50 vehicles in that formation. By the time we got down to the end, the Iraqis were jumping out of the back of their vehicles and running. We'd taken out about, well, three quarters of them before I could only imagine what it must have looked like from the rear, watching these vehicles getting blown up, and we're just coming down their formation. And so I could see these guys, the last few vehicles, these guys are just bailing, started running. And so we took them prisoner. Didn't have that many people. We had a lot more prisoners than we had people to guard them. And which was another event. But once we gathered them all up, had them compiled, that was one thing that we didn't work on too much in terms of rehearsing. But we got them, had them gathered up, and I was driving around the area, kind of looking, doing an assessment, figuring out what was left. Making sure that nobody was, none of my guys were injured and, doing an ammo assessment, that sort of thing. I came back around to where the prisoners were. And Marines were standing around them. And so I climbed out of the vehicle, climbed out of my LAV, had a helmet on. And I can't, I don't, I imagine, I don't know what they were thinking. But when I got out of the vehicle and I start climbing, you climb down the front of the vehicle and then jump off the front and land both feet on the ground. When I did that, first two things, as soon as I landed on the ground, about four or five of them took off, started running. And I don't know if they were afraid or if they just saw this as an opportunity to try to get away. I don't know. But when the Marines started to shoulder their weapons, they were going to shoot them. So just let them go. Looked at me and said, "Sir, you're gonna get away." I said, "Where are they gonna go?" "It's a desert out there. You got like a, they're gonna run as far as they want. There's nothing there." He just looked at me and said, "More likely, if they don't die of thirst, we'll probably see them again." And so, but that was it. That's how that went. But we turned them over to the division for as POWs, and that was about it. And that was short. That's kind of how that's a little bit about how it went from my point of view, at least.
Right. And the ground war wasn't very long. So, was that like what happened after that big battle?
Oh, interesting. Yeah. But after that, I wanted to go back to my battalion because I was actually detached from the battalion to provide security for the division CP. That's where that action took place. After the battle was done, general the division commander, I came back to, I said, "Well, that's done now." Of course, I didn't know the war was going to end that fast. "I better get back to the battalion." He says, "No, you're not going anywhere. Your company is staying right here for our security." So that kind of took care of that. We moved from there to the Kuwait International Airport. And once we got there, we had no other action. And we got there, and the war was pretty much over by then. We're preparing ourselves to move. We're actually trying to find out if we were going to have to go into Iraq. And so that was the big question, and we were waiting for the answer for that. And the next thing it's like, okay, it's over. In a lot of ways, it was pretty quick. We spent more time waiting to leave than actually fighting the war.
And the last section I wanted to cover was I know you were involved with the invasion of Iraq. So it'd be like, what was your role in the invasion? And it's about a decade later. So you return to Iraq. What was that like?
Well, first off, I came back. I was a battalion commander. I left there, a company commander. Left in the last stop was actually the Kuwait International Airport. 10 years later, I'm a battalion commander, and we fly into the Kuwait International Airport. It was sort of a deja vu moment, even though 10 years had passed. And when I getting off the plane, I'm literally looking around trying to recognize where we were and where we kind of set up our little camp and in the airport and that sort of stuff. And it was a real, like I said, it was a real deja vu because this is where we left off. We're coming back 10 years later to pick up where we left off. That's the way it felt. And we get out there, same kind of s different, but the same. We get out there and it's more or less have hurry up and wait. Now I'm a battalion commander now, so I'm not a, so I got more responsibility. And I was, and LAVs now are more seasoned. I've got at the time, nobody wanted to be in LAVs when I was a company commander. Since then, everybody wanted to be on LAVs. It went from like elbow, everybody was pretty much elbowing themselves to get into LAVs. We had guys that were like, people were opting to try to get in LAVs, and they were in the Naval Academy, the Naval Academy graduates trying to get, trying to get in LAVs. Like, wow, that's, so you can imagine different group. Real good. They're all good. And and it's funny because I would have thought they're generally, well, I should say they were generally smarter. I hate to say it. It hate to come to that, but they were generally smarter. But they were all they're more focused, and it was a good unit. We get to get there, and we have to wait. So we built same kind of situation I built on. I had this gunny in the battalion. We built some training facility. We built a training facility. Another thing I made sure we brought was a one of those little projectors, for a digital projector and and all the movie discs we could muster. I remember I wanted to make sure because I've been there where we're just out there in the middle of nowhere and sitting there and staring at the stars because there's nothing to do. So we did that. And of course the training had to do training. So what we did was we took all these little crates that all our equipment came in that was stored on ships. They were in these crates that were made with plywood and 2x4s, basically. We took all those pieces of plywood and all the wood, took those crates apart, and we made what basically a bunch, sort of like a shoot house. And we just kind of, we built these walls and staggered them around and that sort of thing. And so what we'd do is we'd run scenarios and people, they'd have to, we didn't shoot live ammunition there, but, we'd practice, covering each other, moving from room to room, doing clearance techniques and other things. That was one thing. The other thing we did, took a couple of pieces of 2x4, excuse me, a couple of pieces of plywood, painted it white, and framed it with and stood it up with 2x4s. And when the night came, we'd show a movie on this homemade screen. And the whole idea was to get just to relieve the boredom. Well, come to find out, other people in the division, this is back, General Mattis was the division commander. They heard about this. We were doing movies. Out here in theater, we're doing movies. And so, next thing you know, it's like, okay, if you're gonna have to, you can't have these movies and not let other units come and see them. So that was the thing. Either you let everybody else, participate, or you're just gonna have to stop. So it's like, whatever. So we do these, we had like a movie schedule. And so, so every, I mean, literally, they're just literally sitting on the sand. And I'd see people walking over from, like, from somewhere on the other side of the desert, practically. They'd come meandering in. And some of them would have, they'd get vehicle travel, and they'd be in, stacked on Humvees or whatever they could do, and might meander over. We start the movie, and no incidents, no fights, none, nothing like that. It was just, they just come and watch a movie, and then they take off and go back to their unit. But it had to be after dark because we didn't have, it was outdoors, so we had to just wait until sun went down and then show the movie. It would, it's basically a laptop and with a movie disc in it, and a little one of those little projectors, digital projector, just plugged into a laptop. And that was it. It worked. I mean, the sound wasn't all that great, but it was a good enough, and I think it was probably to our advantage that the sound wasn't that great. Because everybody, was they were quiet. Everybody just kind of, be real quiet so they could hear, make sure they heard. So it was good. It actually went good.
Do you remember any what the movies were?
Oh, geez. I didn't watch them. I never even watched them. There was a, we had a stack of movies from the MWR, something in morale, welfare, and recreation.
Recreation, yeah.
So we had a stack of movies in a case. Just every time we get a, had the opportunity, we'd buy a movie, buy movies. So we had, at least 100 movies, I'd say. And but I never watched them. I was generally, I was generally doing something else, preparing for the next day or doing something. And it was for the troops. It wasn't for me. So.
It's pretty cool that you like you took your past experience where you didn't have something like that, and then once you got into a position of power or influence, you were like, "Oh, I'm gonna look out for my guys and hook them up with some movies." That's pretty awesome.
Well, yeah, because yeah, I remember getting literally bored to death, and the other thing is, I had to have something for them to do, and I couldn't very well do what I did before, where we just kind of trained every day. We literally trained. Let's see, but I think I did 3 days and 2 nights a week, something, and then we took a couple days off. And then it got to the point where I flipped it, and we started training at night three days, and two days in the daytime, because we were getting so good until it was just, it was easier. It was more challenging to do it at night, to do our training at night. So we did. It paid off. But I couldn't do that with a battalion. Now I could have my companies do things like that, which I did. But I wouldn't, I couldn't do it as a battalion. But at the same time, I knew what it was like to be bored, not have entertainment. And so that was one of the things we brought. Also made sure we brought, even though we were going to the desert, we made sure we brought the cold weather stuff. So, which is another mistake we made when we went over there, we didn't bring anything for cold weather. So by the time it got around December-ish, oh man, it was cold. We had nothing but a poncho lighter and a poncho for, to keep warm. And so what the lesson learned was bring everything, and because one of the big mistake was, gee, what is it? You're not going to need this, so leave that behind. No. If it's in the, if it's on your equipment list for your battalion, you bring it. Bring everything. Because it, sure enough, we would use it. There would be a reason. Even the cook kits, the field kitchen. Every unit has a field kitchen. That was one of the, you don't need that. Oh, yeah. That's the most famous first words. That's what I learned was that's almost as bad as the if it only, if you wait till the last minute, it only takes a minute. It's almost to that level. Stupid. But anyway, so bring it. And that's what happened is those field kitchens for the most part. For the most part, you can at least boil water. Boiling water, that seems like it doesn't seem like it would be that important. But when you operate like that, when you operate on the edge of humanity, being able to boil water is pretty important. Just for so many reasons. Just so you have pure water, something that's not going to make you sick to drink. That's the first part. And the second thing is, boiling water can, having hot water that if you got to field wash yourself, having a little, being able to knock the chill off the water that you're using is good. And you can also, those little powdered packets of coffee and whatever, it's hot water is good for that. So it just having being able to make hot water is it's just there's just so many reasons, and nobody it just it never I don't remember it being a priority in, when I was going through training. Nobody was talking about, it's like how important it can be as a morale boost, just being able to make hot water. And but it was it, and it, you do without it and you stop and you realize looking back, it's like, gee whiz, we have hot water. I mean, and so that's one of them.
Yeah, it's like the smallest things that can have an impact. Like this is my experience here is not related at all to yours, but I just remember growing up in Massachusetts, young kid playing baseball. I'd go to baseball camp and we'd be playing baseball probably like, I don't know, 5 hours before we had like a water break. And we would go, or maybe not as long, but then we would go and get, instead of having water, I would have Gatorade and it was the powdered Gatorade. And it was just like the biggest like morale
Yes.
quenching thirst for me that I needed to continue playing baseball for the rest of the day. But so it'd be kind of a comparison, not like war, not on the same level, but just my own experience. I can kind of feel what you're going through.
It's not when you're out there, when you're out there, you're not in, yeah, you're every from the outside looking in, you're at war. From the inside looking out, you're just there surviving. You're just, it's not, you're not thinking strategically. You're just thinking, all you're thinking about is how to make life as tolerable as I can make it under the circumstances. I mean, that's the priority, not, gee whiz, are we gonna, if we take this hill, it's going to change. it's going to tilt the balance of power in the Middle East from, you know, it's like, no, we're not thinking like that. So, you know, that it might be what the president is thinking, you know, Secretary of State, those people, they're probably got that on their mind. We're just trying to, keep warm.
Yeah, very, very good point.
That's the way I looked at it, yeah. And so.
And when you were there, like as a battalion commander, are you planning like operations and things?
Yeah. Well, yeah, you're always two things you try to do. You know, you one of as a battalion commander, which is different than a company commander, but you know, you got a pretty good idea of what's next. You know, you know that when you're when we got there on the ground, once we got on the ground and we got enough forces on now we're going to attack. We knew that. So you spend your entire time trying to see and understand the terrain and the environment that you're going to have to operate in. You know, what are the obstacles you're going to do? Natural obstacles. Where are they? What is the best avenues of approach for them and for you? Try to decide. Figure out where your decision points are. When I say decision points, you gotta operate, you've got enough, I've got enough range to operate my vehicles. Once everything's topped off, I can reach 300 miles, roughly. Well, that's all, that's great to reach 300 miles, but you know, what do I do then? You know, I can't. So I drive until all of my, you know, all the fuel tanks are empty and then just kind of sit there. Somewhere between the empty fuel tanks and where I am right now, I'm gonna have to get refueled. And nobody in some in my fuel refueling capability. They have less of a range than my vehicles themselves. And I don't carry enough refuel capability to totally top off my entire battalion. I can only, you know, I can get them like three quarters full. So my decision point is really more like about 150 miles. I got to get refueled before I hit that 150 mile mark because that's about the limit of my logistics. So where, you know, so I got to I circle the map and look at the terrain around that location, around that distance. So that's a decision point there. You know, whether if the if that terrain around that area is too dangerous, too risky, then I gotta refuel myself before that, before I get there, because I can't do it afterward, or shouldn't let myself do it afterward. So those are the things you're thinking about as a battalion commander, and those are the things that I'm thinking about. How can I pre-plan my fuel? Is there a fuel opportunity? You know, all of a sudden, yeah, I look at the big map and all of a sudden I look at the map and go, gee whiz, about 2 miles to the right, when we get close to here, the army's gonna have, army's got a refuel point over there. If I divert, you know, my path and head over there and get topped off on the army's dime, then I can get right back. Take a, I'll send a company at a time over there. Little things like that. You know, I'm thinking, you know, these aren't accidents. You know, you just have to think about them in advance and use it. Another one we do, I learned because those Apache, those not Apaches, but Cobras were so important until what I realized was that I can refuel Cobras. The Cobra helicopters use the same fuel as the LAVs. So I always made sure that I carried enough fuel so that if I ever needed air support, I made sure that if I call for Cobras, I make sure that my FAC tells them I've got the ability to refuel. They're willing to stay. They're willing to hang out, you know. If you can refuel them, all they want to do is make sure they can get back. So they're always going to make sure they got enough fuel to get back to their home base. Now, if I have fuel for them, they can stay longer on. And normally, so again, when they land, we refuel them and give them some, give them an MRE and some hot water. Did I
Did you
do
do that when you were in?
that?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. As a matter of fact, these guys got, and I used to love that because it was so great to operate because you're in LAVs, you're at the pointy end, so you don't have much support. And of course, people are back there in the back hoarding everything they can. And so you get the Cobras up there and then you top them off. They realize you got hot water. Hot water is, like I said, it's a big thing. And people, I don't, it's like that's that hidden secret, You got hot water for them. The next thing so they can, the MREs have a little powdered coffee and so on in there. And like I said, they can wash up. Being able to wash up is, it's a big thing. And especially you got some warm water to do it instead of, like cold. Oh, it's huge. So yeah, I do that. Make sure they knew. And matter of fact, it was so bad. These guys used to come and hang out until they'd call. We get a radio call like, "Hey, you got are these helicopters with you?" It's like I kind of felt like that teenager, who's kind of stayed away from home. He was supposed to be back. I was supposed to be back by 10. I'm still hanging out with the buddies, and then you get to call from the parents like, where are you? What's going on? You're supposed to be back. It's like, well, that's the way we were with the with those helicopters. We'd have them there hanging around. The guys would, they'd hang out, get the hot food, and topped off, and they knew they could get back, so they just hang around. And so yeah, they call every now and then and go, "Well, hey, you got helicopters hanging up there. They're supposed to be back. They're supposed to be back." They have radios in their helicopters, but if they're not in their helicopter, they're not getting the call.
And I have two questions. Are you in like a vehicle when you're planning like the routes on the map, or are you like in like a center where you're looking at a map on maybe the wall, or maybe it's on a table and you have miniature figurines? I don't know. How'd that work?
We had something called, we have a command and control vehicle, and my XO actually manages that. And of course that staff, they call it the in LAVs they call them C squareds. It's a C2 variant, and it's just a vehicle. It's like a logistics vehicle with a bunch of radios in it and seats. And that's where most of the that well, that's where the operational management went. But for the most part, when it came down to the planning side, if we had a chance to set up a tent, and we had these little, headquarters tents like the army has with, 100 people in them or whatever. But we'd have a tent. Really wasn't too fancy, really, just a piece of plywood, stick the map on the side of on it, and then and that would be what we'd use. We just do the up, update the map, put a piece of acetate over the map, and just update the map with basically a grease pencil, or and we do generally use grease pencils because if you use dry erase, you could accidentally wipe it off. Now, grease pencils, it's kind of smooshy, it's not as neat, but it would stay there. So yeah, it was, I mean, that was about as good as it got. We started transitioning to maps on laptops, but you have a big 1 to 50 thousandths map, you get a lot more granularity and context. And when you see when you have a big map sheet as opposed to a picture on a screen, just I don't know, I could process it better. And I can process it better when I see it on a big paper map.
That makes sense. And so where was the starting point, and where did you end up? How much distance did you cover? What happened during that push?
Well, we started in from Kuwait, obviously. Went We drove to Baghdad in the first push, and then from there we drove even further north to oh geez, what's the name of the town where Saddam Hussein was actually captured. We went a long way. We went the entire, almost the entire length of the country. At least our part, my part did. And mostly because by the time we got finished, by the time we our attack, we did the attack up to Baghdad, by the time we got to Baghdad, almost all our track vehicles were done. The track vehicles, the Amtraks and tanks at the time, things like they were. And the tracks were pretty much worn out. The road wheels, rubber just flying off the road wheels, and oh man, it was pretty desolate. And we just made it, just logistically, just barely made it to Baghdad as a division, as a. And then we decided we were going to go further north. And so, General Kelly. This was obviously it was a decision made by General Mattis and General Kelly. They collected up all our wheeled assets, which was the LAVs, all the LAVs, the towed artillery, and whatever else they felt like they needed. And we moved on. We continued north, so we went all the way to, forget the name of the town now, but anyway, we went that far. And in the meantime, on the way, we went through a place where some of the Americans were held. Matter of fact, a buddy of mine. Anyway, his battalion, as we were driving through, somebody And Iraqi kind of told him, hey, there's some Americans back here prisoner. So we stopped. He sent some people to check it out. And sure enough, it was the army guys that they got attacked. They got lost early on in the campaign, in the invasion. They got lost and then they got captured. And so he ended up taking, rescuing them. And we went on to the end of the to where Saddam was captured in that part of Iraq, and we held that place until the army came along and relieved us. And it was interesting because the army relieved us, they sent the 10th Cavalry. Which this guy shows up to my position in a small helicopter and lands and says, Colonel so and so, I'm the CO of the 10th Cavalry. Looked at him and said, 10th Cavalry, like, are you like the Buffalo Soldiers? And he looked at me and smiled. He said, yeah. He said, and he gave me a coin. It was a Buffalo Soldier. They still, they 10th Cavalry still exists. Of course, it's a little more sophisticated than it used to be back then, back in post-Civil War, Indian War days. But the Army's version of cavalry is a little different than the Marine Corps version. But yeah. So we were relieved by the 10th Cavalry, and that's so we went clean from Kuwait through Baghdad north to oh my goodness, I'd have to look at a map to recall, but it was we went quite a ways, and we had to give up. Literally, all the tracked vehicles in the Marine Corps were part of the invasion. They couldn't even travel. They barely made it to Baghdad because it just takes far too much sustainment for them to make it that far. Which is part of the reason I think the Marine Corps has made the decision to the last commandant made the decision that we're going to leave tanks behind. So Marine Corps, I don't know if you know, the Marine Corps doesn't have any more tanks.
I did not know that.
Yeah. So, no, they're gone. The decision was made, if we need tanks, we'll get the support, tank support from the Army. And to some degree, a lot of people would get upset at me saying this, but to some degree, I agree. Tanks are at a much greater risk than they've ever been because of drones. And it's the evolution of warfare. Somebody comes along and everything from sticks, the evolution of fighting with clubs to somebody showing up with a sword, and then somebody shows up with arrows and trebuchets that throw big rocks, and it's like all of a sudden warfare has to change, has to change with technology. So it's here we are. So we're kind of looking at a revolution of technology, in my opinion. If people pay attention to what's happening in Ukraine right now, you could see, the awareness that, hey, wait a minute. Warfare is shifting right in front of our eyes. So it is what it is.
Yeah, I agree. I think you're spot on. We've been going at it for almost 3 hours. I think we could. You have an open invite if you ever want to come back on my podcast, because it's just I could talk to you literally like forever, because I just think you have a wealth of experience and you're an interesting person. Plus, we can talk football, and we have a lot of that in common. But I just wanted to ask, What would you did mention before that your proudest experience was the teaching your guys how to study and go to college. But if you could add another memorable experience or memorable your legacy in the Marines, what do you think your would be your proudest accomplishment?
I think probably being there to influence the importance of light armored vehicles, being part of that breakthrough or that moment of awareness that that vehicle is an important one. Now it is the symbol in a lot of the ads that you see, the Marine Corps promoting, you see the LAV, the vehicle, that's the symbol, if you will, that right now that the Marine Corps is using in their marketing. And I marvel at it because I remember when, getting assigned to the LAVs was the kiss of death. And now it's like it's almost like the icon, in a way. If you ever look at the Marine Corps recruiting poster, with the warfare thing and going on, look, and there's an LAV in the picture. It's pretty, to me, it's pretty cool to be at the front end of it. And it really is because of circumstances, how things played out. If the Iraqis hadn't tried to attack on that day, at that location, who knows? But they did, and that's how it played out. So, anyway, so that's probably the thing. If you want to pick something, it's just the fact that it's being a part of that. I consider it a watershed moment for the LAV. All these guys, man, General Kelly, who used to be the chief of staff of, under the Trump administration, he was an LAV battalion commander. General Neller, who ended up being commandant of the Marine Corps, he was an LAV battalion commander. Those are two. A lot of guys who were LAV battalion commanders that were end up retiring as generals, that's for sure. But it's kind of nice to see something with, that was once the kiss of death become what everybody wanted to do. Part of it because, hey, you know what? After these guys kind of went to the LAVs, they became, generals, and now if you're a lieutenant, gee whiz, it's like following those footsteps, maybe. So they're looking at it, they look at it altogether different now. And so I'm kind of proud of that, being a part of that.
Hey everyone, this is Matt. This concludes part two with Eddie Ray. If you like the episode, please subscribe and tell a buddy about the podcast, whether it's a fellow Marine, a future or current leader, or just a history buff. I truly appreciate you taking the time to listen to the very end. You're the real MVP.